From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. New York City has gone 24 hours without a coronavirus death for the first time since the pandemic began. But Mayor Bill de Blasio's announcement today is a rare glimmer of good news as the virus spreads unchecked in other parts of the country.
On Sunday, Florida reported more than 15,000 new cases, shattering California and New York's records for new cases in a single state in one day. For more, we have Miami Herald reporter Ben Konark via Skype. And Ben, these Florida numbers are much higher than what we saw in New York during its COVID-19 peak. How concerning is this spike?
Well, it's important to keep in mind with, new case numbers that we're testing a lot right now here in Florida. You know, this record number that we saw yesterday was also a record day in testing. What you should look at and what is very concerning is the percent positivity, still not being anywhere near where you would want it to be. And then what's more concerning than that is hospitalizations and deaths.
Give us a sense of what you're seeing in terms of hospitalizations and deaths.
Sure. So the hospitalizations was really something we were flying blind on for a long time here in the state of Florida. Here in Miami-Dade County, we'd always had real-time numbers of hospitalizations, but across the state, that wasn't available, even though we had started to figure out within the last month that the state actually did have access to these data, but they were not reporting it. Last week, they finally reported the number of people who are hospitalized with COVID in the state, and it was around 7,000. Well, now over the weekend, we're already up to about 8,000. So it's going in the wrong direction. And it's really a statewide rise in people who are hospitalized with COVID.
I want to ask you about something else. Republican Governor DeSantis has closed down bars and says he won't reopen them. Can you give us a sense of how much is currently open in the state? And is there a chance the state gets a stay-at-home order again?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. So I don't know if the stay-at-home order is being discussed, but here in Miami-Dade, we were not opening at the same rate that other places in the state were opening, and yet we still see this resurgence of the virus. Here in Miami right now, you can still do things that you weren't able to do during the safer at-home order. For instance, you can go, have a meal outside. And, the beaches are open again, although they were closed briefly for July 4th weekend. But overall, it's not like the floodgates have been opened here. There are still a lot of restrictions in place, but we are seeing a lot of virus transmission despite that. And what local leaders have tied that to is, people kind of doing things on their own, having house parties, having gatherings, Airbnbs that turn into makeshift nightclubs. And I think part of this is a larger cultural issue in Florida, where we have a governor who for a long time was downplaying the severity of this virus and, never did a statewide mask mandate, often kind of singled out the press as an issue, more so than the virus itself. And so now we are dealing with a lot of people here in Florida who don't seem to think that this is an issue that actually affects them or is one they should take seriously.
What has been the reaction to Governor DeSantis's call for the reopening of schools in August?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of uncertainty and nervousness about that decision. I think there's a lot of disbelief. We don't really know what this virus does to children yet. In fact, we don't really know what it does to adults. There are long-term consequences of this virus that we do not understand. We're starting to learn more about. And there are questions about transmission. So it's, obviously a heated issue. A lot of people would like to see schools reopen. But it's just at this point, I think there's a lot of uncertainty and nervousness about the idea of sending kids into school when we have just this really kind of uncontrolled spread of the virus happening throughout the state right now.
Hmm. A Disney ad made the rounds on social media in advance of this weekend's opening of Disney World. It shows park workers in masks. Let's listen.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Again, this was in advance of Disney World opening. It's now open for business again. What do you make of that?
Other than social media visuals of what's going on at Disney, I don't know what exactly it looks like. I know they're taking precautions, but I will say it's surreal for me as a healthcare reporter and someone who talks a lot to doctors and nurses here in Miami to see this happening in the same state. I mean, it's like if in a thrust of New York's crisis, you had people down at Chelsea Pier riding a Ferris wheel. It just doesn't make any sense why you would have this open. And I understand they're taking precautions to try and control it, but it just, you know, we are in a state of crisis in Florida right now, and there's really no part of the state that's been untouched by that. So to have Walt Disney open is certainly a bit of cognitive dissonance, to put it lightly.
That's Miami Herald reporter Ben Konark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, coronavirus is affecting countries around the world, and there are some alarming numbers coming out of the Middle East. COVID-19 is surging in Saudi Arabia, for example, with 3,000 new cases yesterday. Joining us now is NPR's Jane Arraf. She's in Amman, Jordan. Jane, give us the big picture of coronavirus in the part of the world where you are.
Well, it varies really quite a lot. I'm in Jordan, where they've gotten cases, local transmission cases, community spread down to almost zero. But on the other hand, huge spikes that we're seeing in Saudi Arabia. Iran isn't doing very well. Places like Egypt, where it's very hard to conduct social distancing, also has had spikes in cases. And really, a lot of it is tied to the fact that these countries are saying they can't just keep the economy closed forever because people will either go hungry or they'll riot.
Well, and when it comes to Iran, which has by far the most cases in the region, what do we know about how the government there is handling the pandemic? Because it is notoriously difficult to find out exactly what's going on the ground in Iran.
It is. So Iran, you'll remember, was one of those early epicenters of infection, starting way back in late February, and it's still struggling. It has registered now more than 250,000 cases. So the government response really has been to say that they're going to ban some things, including weddings and funerals, because that's the way a lot of the cases have been thought to have been transmitted. But there's an important caveat there, because President Hassan Rouhani says they're undergoing U.S. sanctions targeting oil sales, so their economy is in shambles. He says in the midst of all that, they can't afford to shut down the economy. And the health minister there has actually warned of a potential revolt over poverty. So it's a very fine line they're trying to tread there, but cases are continuing to rise because basically they're saying they just can't keep the economy closed forever.
What about in neighboring Iraq? I know you've done a lot of reporting from there, and coronavirus cases spiked there recently. How's Iraq doing, and do they have the medical resources to cope with a surge?
Yeah, Iraq is really problematic. So Iraq obviously has a lot of oil wealth, but it's a country with an economy and a health system particularly in crisis. The cases of coronavirus, people testing positive, spiked like 600% in June. And it's a healthcare system that suffered years of neglect and corruption. So here's one small example. The main hospital in the southern province of Dakar has been running out of oxygen. There are people who need it, who can't get it, patients. Patients' relatives have rioted. They fixed that problem, but now it's risen up again. And the government is investigating whether it's corruption that's led to the shortage of oxygen. So WHO, the UN agency, has rushed in oxygen concentrators. They've asked for help from China. And the thing is, really, in Iraq, like in other countries, this pandemic has really highlighted basically all of these existing fractures in government services. In Iraq, we're seeing a really extreme case of that and the effect on the healthcare system.
And what about in Syria, where there has been a civil war going on for more than 9 years? The case numbers, at least what we've been able to see from the outside, have been relatively low, but it sounds like now there are some reports of cases in the north where they're still fighting.
So in the northwest, which is one of the rebel-held areas, we saw the first cases just a few days ago, three doctors and a nurse. And here's the fear. There are hundreds of thousands of displaced Syrians there. And the fear is that it will spread really quickly through these camps for displaced people. Health officials, aid officials are warning that, you know, most of these people don't have access to soap. They don't have access to running water. And so it's a critical time there. And there's a lot of worry over what happens in those areas.
So let's go back around to Jordan, where you are, which is a place that, as you said, has relatively few cases.
So, yeah, Jordan imposed one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. It banned people from leaving their homes at all at first for anything but emergencies. It shut down even grocery stores. So now almost all the cases it's finding are from truck drivers coming from Saudi Arabia or returning expats. But the problem is that even though it's done really well domestically, how does it open up again to other countries, to its neighbors? Saudi Arabia, for instance, is suffering a lot. It's had a big spike in cases, and a lot of it is from migrant laborers. You know, those big skyscrapers, mm-hmm. the football stadiums in the Gulf, they're built with foreign laborers. And they're living in very close quarters, sleeping in bunk beds. A lot of those people will leave, but right now they're suffering even higher rates of the virus. And mm-hmm. that's one of the things that's going to change the shape of the Middle East, probably for years to come, even after this pandemic is over.
That is NPR's Jane Arraf speaking with us from Amman, Jordan. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
The pandemic has upended transportation. In many cities, there's still very light traffic on the roads with so many people working from home. Public transit has seen a plummet in ridership because of concerns about gathering together on a bus or in a train with strangers. And of course, the airlines are in big trouble. United announced last week it could lay off as many as 36,000 employees, even after billions in aid from Washington. Let's talk about all of that with Ray LaHood, former Secretary of Transportation under President Obama and former Republican Congressman from Illinois, now the co-chair of the group Building America's Future. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, in an MIT study released last month found an increase in COVID-19 death rates in counties where more people use public transit compared to those where telecommuting is more common. The researchers controlled for race, income, age, climate, and other characteristics. Do you think it is safe for people to use public transit right now? And what should transit agencies be doing to make it safe?
Well, I think that transit agencies have a responsibility, like every other transportation system, to assure people that when they get on a train or a bus, that it's the safest it can possibly be. And there has to be very strict guidelines. They have to assure people that they've sanitized the piece of equipment, whether it's a train car or a bus. They have to require every person on the vehicle or whatever the mode of transportation is to wear a mask. And in the absence of that kind of requirement, I think people are not going to ride transit. They just simply are not. But if they can be assured that it's safe to get on these modes of transportation, I believe they will. And so it's really incumbent upon the transit agencies to have strict requirements for cleaning, strict requirements for wiping down equipment, and strict requirements for the people who are riding and the people that are driving the vehicles. And they just have to enforce it.
Well, do you think that we're there yet? Would you feel safe right now getting on, let's say, the New York City subway, or would you feel safe getting on a bus in Kansas City?
Well, to put it more bluntly, I've been spending almost all my time in Illinois, where I have a home in Peoria. There's a bus service from O'Hare to my hometown of Peoria that a lot of college students use. Unless I was assured that bus has been completely sanitized and requires everybody to wear a mask, I would not get on it. And, you know, I think people who live in New York and who've been through the this epidemic and seen what's happened to their fellow citizens have to be assured that the subways are cleaned and cleansed, and that the people that are operating the system and the people riding the system are wearing masks. We know that when that occurs, that you're really preventing the coronavirus from spreading.
The pandemic has also been called an existential threat to transit financing. Patrick Foy, the chairman of New York's MTA, called it a four-alarm fire. What do you think that the long-term impact of the pandemic will be on transit financing?
Well, when you look at what previous Congresses have done, 40% of the money for transit, 40% comes from the federal government. I think in order to provide to transit systems the kind of opportunity to get people back on buses and trains, you have to give them the resources that they've lost as a result of the fact that these systems have basically been shut down without any passengers. And so what I'm saying is there will probably have to be an increase in the funding from the federal government to allow for transit systems to make up for some of the deficiencies, but also to allow for the kind of cleansing and sanitation and distribution of masks and so forth in the short term for the next several months, so that when these requirements are put in place, it's backed up with the fact that the money is going to be there to do it. And I think that does then give people the assurance that the transit agencies and our government are doing everything they can to meet every requirement possible to keep people safe.
So money needs to come, you're saying, from the federal government to deal with the short-term impacts. What about the long-term situation? We're reading that some transit agencies are actually able to get more things done right now. They're able to fast-track some projects because ridership is so low that they can do the work they need to do more quickly, not to mention that borrowing money is very cheap right now. Are you seeing any positive impacts on transit infrastructure from the pandemic?
Well, if what you say is accurate and transit agencies are able to fix up their infrastructure because of low ridership, that obviously is a plus. But my prediction is that transit agencies around the country will not get back to a normalcy that they had before coronavirus until there's a vaccine. Until there's a vaccine, and I feel that way about the airline industry and other forms of transportation, but certainly transit. People are leery of getting on in a closed, crowded situation when there's not the assurance that the safety measures are there or that people that are on there don't have the virus.
Well, on the issue of airlines, let me ask you, as a former transportation secretary, what would you be doing right now when it comes to the airlines? Because we're seeing billions of dollars from the CARES Act going to the airlines to keep them afloat. But at the same time, you're hearing about an airline like United sending off layoff warnings to 36,000 employees.
Well, I think somebody is going to look into that, because I think when you accept the loans from the federal government, the loans are to go to pay people so they don't have to be laid off. And I think if the layoffs are coming, I don't know if that violates the provisions of the loan, but obviously somebody will look into that. Look, if I was Secretary of Transportation, what I would be doing today is requiring the airlines to distance people, not to fill up every seat, number one. Number two, require all employees to wear masks. Number three, require all passengers to wear masks. And number four, clean the planes after every flight. In the absence of that, people are not going to fly. They just simply are not.
Well, do you think that the federal government should spend whatever it takes to keep all of the airlines stable through this crisis?
Absolutely. I think they not only should provide the resources, but they should provide the regulations and require those regulations to be put in place in order to qualify for the idea that the federal government is going to help them financially. There has to be a responsibility that comes with the resources. And I think the responsibilities have to be 100% assurance that when passengers get on these planes, they're following the CDC guidelines. You know, I would even go so far as to test passengers as they get on a plane with some kind of a temperature test.
Let me ask you about one more aspect of transportation, which is that with so many people social distancing and isolating, some cities have started to devote more space to pedestrians in places that used to be packed with cars. Do you foresee the pandemic changing the way that our cities work and giving more space over to pedestrians in the long term?
In the long term, I think when there's a vaccine, we'll get back to the normalcy that we saw before the pandemic. I think in the short term, communities all over America are trying anything that they can to keep people safe. And when you look at most cities and most responsible mayors and most responsible governors, they're trying to be innovative and creative in keeping people safe. And so I think that the long term is going to require a vaccine in order to get back to normal.
Secretary LaHood, do you think that there's going to be a big difference in what happens with transportation in this country if President Trump wins versus if Joe Biden wins the election?
Oh, there's no question about it. No question about it. I think under a Biden administration, you're going to see the federal government really step up and in the short term require the kind of rules and regulations that will protect people and give people the state of mind and the state of security that when they get on a plane, there'll be social distancing. There'll be people with masks on. The planes will be cleaned and people will be required to have their temperature taken or something like that. If you look at what mayors and governors are doing around the country on transit, that's clearly what they're doing. They're trying to give people the assurance that transit is safe, but they have to do that by putting in some pretty tough rules and regulations.
And if Trump wins?
Same old, more of the same. Kind of a free-for-all, let people do whatever the hell they want.
That is Ray LaHood, the former Secretary of Transportation under President Obama, former Republican congressman from Illinois, and now co-chair of the group Building America's Future. Secretary LaHood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Take care.
As more and more colleges opt to hold classes online this fall, some students and their families are wondering whether the price tag will be worth it. While a few colleges, like Williams College in Massachusetts, have cut tuition by 15% in Williams' case, most are charging the same. And some, like NYU and the University of Missouri, are actually increasing prices. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, first of all, it's not exactly clear what all the schools are going to be doing, right? We know Harvard and the University of California system, for example, are going to hold all the classes online this fall. But do we have a sense of what other schools are doing?
Well, it's been all over the place and it continues to evolve. It looks like the most popular format that college will take is some hybrid model. So some online, some in class, some changing the academic calendar. For example, maybe instead of two semesters, you have three trimesters. And what's clear also is that these plans could shift pretty dramatically, especially in those regions where we've seen the virus pick up dramatically. So a lot of plans were announced a few months ago, still changing up to this moment.
So if you have a hybrid model, or if you have an online only model, or if you have a model where the students come in until Thanksgiving and then they go home instead of coming back for the rest of the semester, how are they justifying the fact that prices should either stay the same or even go up?
God bless them that this is like the college mantra. I don't know. I think this is a head scratcher. When I saw that tuition was going up, as you mentioned, at NYU or in other areas, in other colleges, it was really mind blowing to me, especially considering that what they are basically saying is the college experience, this amazing ivory tower type of experience, which, you know, is a little overblown, let's be honest, for anyone who's gone through it, it is really is about being there, being part of a campus life, being with with your colleagues, being with your cohort, talking to your professors. Well, that's not happening. So I don't really understand why they're saying it, except for this. They make a funny economic argument. They'll say, well, we need to charge you tuition because that if you don't, we don't charge you tuition, we can't actually have a big endowment. We can't have you finance other people who are on financial aid. And the answer is pretty clear. Just admit more people. What's the big deal? If you're going to be in an online hybrid model, you can actually increase your enrollment. What's the big deal? I don't get it.
You know, a lot of people won't be paying right up front for their tuition. They'll be taking on student debt. We've got 44 million Americans in this country owing about $1.6 trillion right now, roughly equal to Russia's entire GDP. Jill, do you think that this new reality is going to change the thinking at all on how much debt is worth going into for a college degree and what might be done about all that debt?
Well, I think the problem with college debt is that we have sold the American public on the idea, which is true, that a college degree will help you earn more money over your work life. And it is true the data will actually confirm that. But what we haven't done is actually said, well, if you actually are making more money, but you're paying to finance all that debt, does it really make sense? I think that there could be a change in the political winds if maybe Joe Biden were to win. But it's still a tough battle. I don't think that there's going to be wholesale excitement around, oh, let's just release $1.6 trillion in debt. And yet we have to be smarter until the system does change about how families accumulate this debt. Please be careful out there, gang. Try not to go crazy here.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Former NFL linebacker Emmanuel Acho made headlines a few days ago after speaking out about NFL star DeSean Jackson's anti-Semitic posts on social media. On his Fox Sports show, Speak for Yourself, Acho said that while Jackson was wrong for his statements, he shouldn't be banished because of them.
I'm done with cancel culture. I'm done with, man, DeSean Jackson. What did he just say? Let's be done with them. Because what cancel culture doesn't do, Marcellus, it doesn't educate, and it doesn't allow room for growth.
For the last month, Acho has been educating people about race and racism in a YouTube series called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. I spoke with him recently about why he believes it's now important to educate versus punish, and why he believes it's his role to serve as educator.
So I really understood that America is facing, again, the racial divide. And so I realized I can stand in and bridge the gap between my white brothers and sisters and my Black brothers and sisters. So let me be that Black friend and create a safe space answering so many questions that my dear white brothers and sisters have so that they can no longer live in ignorance.
Okay, I want to ask you about the burden of that, but first, you, I've heard you also say that you never knew white people had so many questions until you started this project. And you feel they need a safe, non-judgmental space to ask them. Say more about that in particular.
I was sitting 2 weeks ago at my dear white friend's house. It was a couple. And they were like, well, Emmanuel, how can we get exposed to more Black people? If our problem is our lack of exposure, how can we get exposed? And I said, well, you know, you can go to a Black church. And they were like, Black church? We thought that was your thing. Like, we thought that was a Black person's safe space. And I said, oh, my gosh. There are questions that white people have that because they never ask, they live their whole life under this premonition that is just totally wrong. And so it was really for that reason that I decided to put this together, because our world would be so much better off if we just understood and exposed ourselves emotionally to each other more.
Emmanuel, do you ever or have you ever felt the burden of having to be a teacher in this way?
I don't feel as though it's a burden, because I feel like as though it's my calling. I feel as though I'm commissioned to do so. I played in the NFL for 4 years. But Tanya, ultimately, if what I am doing can help change the world and save a life, Even if it is a burden, so be it. I got a sweet message, Tanya, from a woman named Lynn. And she said, Emmanuel, I'm 73 years old and I grew up in rural Alabama. Go to school with any Negroes, she said. She said, I became a flight attendant and I got a little more exposure. But your video, it showed me I still have a long ways to go. Please don't give up on me yet. I love you, my son and my brother. And Tanya, if a burden is leading to messages like that, then please burden me all the more.
Yeah. You know, in your most recent video, you sit down with the Gaines family from the show Fixer Upper. What's the toughest question you've gotten so far?
The Gaines' sweet 8-year-old daughter, I believe she's 8, maybe 10, their sweet daughter, Emmy, she looked at me during the most recent episode and she said, are you afraid of white people? She asked me that and I said, Emmy, I'm not afraid of white people, but I'm cautious of white people because like electricity and water, they are both imperative to our society. You need water to survive and electricity, it obviously is of great benefit. But I do understand what will happen if electricity and water have a negative interaction. That was probably the toughest yet most pure question I've had to answer, and it was from a child.
Yeah. You mentioned your sports career. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell made a video apologizing for not listening to black players about police brutality and racism. He did not, however, mention Colin Kaepernick in that by name in that video. But what actions would you like to see the NFL take?
I need the NFL to not just be about talk, Tanya. I need to see them really put steps into practice, meaning in 2018, the NFL's commissioner, the most powerful man in the NFL, he made a rule, a legislation that NFL players were not allowed to take a knee during the national anthem. Well, now in 2020, he says he fully supports the players' ability to peacefully protest. Which one is it, Commissioner Roger Goodell? Which one is it? It has now become abundantly clear that the protest is not to disrespect any of our prior or current military members, but simply to raise awareness. So I would hope that the commissioner, beyond just giving money, removes some of the barriers that he put in place that barred athletes, his athletes, predominantly his black athletes, from peacefully protesting.
As I mentioned earlier in the second episode of Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man, you spoke with Matthew McConaughey. Let's listen to a clip.
Individually. And I was telling you, I'm big on values and I feel them deteriorating across the board. How someone like me, how can I do better as a human? How can I do better as a man? How can I do better as a white man?
Emmanuel, is that the number one question you received? And what's your answer?
My answer is first, Tanya, by listening, by educating yourself. Another reason I started this video series was because so many of my dear white friends were like, I want to help, Emmanuel. And I was like, wait, you must first educate yourself as to what fight you were fighting. So many of my dear white friends, they think and they were convinced that black people were exclusively fighting because of the tragic murder of George Floyd, when black people are still crying tears from Emmett Till's death in 1955, the 14-year-old boy who was mutilated and murdered by two white men because a white woman falsely claimed he flirted with her. In 2017, that white woman who made that claim about Emmett Till recanted that story. To my knowledge, she's still alive today. Black people are crying and burdened with years and years upon oppression. So what can they do to help? What can my dear white friends do to help? Educate themselves as to what are black people truly experiencing, Tanya. I told the story of how I pull up to my mailbox in my affluent neighborhood in Austin, and if there's a white woman walking near her mailbox, also near mine, I'll sit in my car because I don't want her to perceive me as a threat simply because I'm large and I am black. And so what can white people do to help? Understand what black men and black women are going through and help alleviate some of our pain.
These conversations are just some of the many to come in your series. What can we expect?
Oh, there's so many things to tackle. I want to tackle interracial relationships. Remember, it was just 53 years ago that I guess the Loving Court case that America finally allowed black and white people to marry. I want to tackle that because there's still so many stereotypes from the white side and from the black side. I would love to speak to someone in the military about this whole national anthem thing, about the peacefully protest and why they feel disrespected. And I would love for them to come have an uncomfortable conversation. There's so many barriers, Tanya, that I still desire to break down. And for those that continue to watch my stories on my Instagram page at TheManAcho and my Twitter page, they will continue to see these barriers broken down and the lives being changed.
You know, I just had a thought, Emmanuel. I asked you if it was a burden to have these conversations or serve as a teacher. But it sounds like, listening to you, that it's also therapeutic for you.
The therapeutic part is seeing America come together. Like, personally, I'm first generation American. And so the beauty of my genealogy and lineage is that I don't have that burden of dealing with the years and years of oppression and slavery that has left me marred with so much pain, like my dear Black brothers and sisters. And so I am truly just ecstatic to be able to bring people groups together and to be able to bring forth understanding. My life is filled with so many cultures, so many educational levels. And so for me, the therapy is in seeing lives change more than it's personal therapy.
That's former NFL linebacker Emmanuel Acho talking about his new series, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. Emmanuel, thank you so much.
Tanya, thank you.
Republican Senator Mitt Romney called it historic, unprecedented corruption, but he was one of the only Republican lawmakers to speak out against President Trump's commutation of the sentence of Trump's longtime friend Roger Stone, who was convicted of lying to investigators about what he and then candidate Trump knew about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. Joining us now is Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, what was your reaction when you first saw the news on Friday night that President Trump was commuting the sentence of Roger Stone?
You know, it was the usual mixture in the Trump era of shock on the one hand and not being surprised on the other. But it's a real body blow to the rule of law in this country that under this presidency, there are two standards of justice. There's one for friends and cronies and accomplices of the president, and then there's one for everybody else. If you're willing to lie for the president, if you're willing to intimidate witnesses and obstruct and cover up for the president, then essentially you get out of jail free. And that's an appalling degradation of the democracy in this country.
Do you think there are any risks for the president in doing what he did?
There certainly should be. You know, I think that he will suffer in public opinion, which will hurt him in the fall. But the reason he can get away with it, frankly, is that the Republicans in Congress are so supine that they won't stand up to him. Nixon considered pardoning people that were implicated in his own wrongdoing, but he understood that he couldn't get away with it. And the reason he couldn't is because Republicans in Congress would have stood up to that kind of a clear abuse. But here, apart from one or two GOP senators, they don't say a word. And this is what lets Donald Trump get away with it.
What about impeaching the president again? Is that being discussed?
I don't know that it's being discussed, you know, given the fact that with the Senate confronted with overwhelming evidence in the impeachment just a few months ago, apart from the courage that Mitt Romney showed, none of the Republicans were willing to stand up to this president. Nothing gives us much confidence they would now either.
Given that, is there anything that the president could do right now, between now and the election, that would be a bridge too far that would cause you to think about impeachment again? Or can he pretty much do whatever he wants right now without consequence?
Well, I certainly would not say that he can do whatever he wants without consequence. And there's no telling what this president will do. But the reality is 130,000 Americans are dead now. And a lot of this, I think, is a responsibility of the grossly incompetent handling of this crisis by the President of the United States. We warned during the trial that if he were left in office just in the intervening months, he could do a lot of damage We, in fact, had no idea how much damage he would go on to do. But it's hard to imagine a more catastrophic last year of a presidency than the one we're in right now.
Senator Lindsey Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, said, quote, "In my view, it would be justified if President Trump decided to commute Roger Stone's prison sentence. Mr. Stone is in his 70s, and this was a nonviolent first-time offense." Now, Stone is actually not in his 70s. He's in his 60s. But how do you respond to that from the chairman of the Judiciary Committee?
Well, it's appalling. And again, this is why Donald Trump, at least politically in the Congress, can get away with it, because he has people like Lindsey Graham to seed the ground for him. I can't imagine during Watergate one of the Republican senators, let alone the chair of the Judiciary Committee, publicly, you know, encouraging the president to pardon or commute the sentence of someone in Watergate. I mean, imagine in any other circumstance, a member of Congress, let alone the chair of the Judiciary Committee, saying, "It's fine to lie to Congress. You don't have to go to jail. You can intimidate witnesses. That's perfectly okay, just as long as you do it for the president of our party to help him cover up."
Let me just finally ask you a question about the coronavirus pandemic, because your home state of California is one of the states that's seeing significant spikes right now after it appeared that things were really under control. Why do you think that is? Why has California fallen into the same basket right now as states like Texas and Florida and Georgia that didn't take the extreme measures in the beginning that California did?
Because we fell behind in testing, and we never developed fully the tracing capability that we need to reopen. We simply, nationwide, and this is true in California too, have not been able to keep a close enough eye on where the virus is to be able to trace it when people get sick and isolate them and treat them. And without all of those things in place, it's only a matter of time before the virus gains ground. And sadly, we're seeing that throughout the whole country. And it really, calls for a strong level of leadership at the very top. And instead, at the very top, you have a president talking down the seriousness of the virus, trying to ignore it, trying to silence people like Dr. Fauci, who are warning of it. And the result is disaster.
That is Congressman Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.